From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The United Nations evacuates from East Timor, though they do leave a skeletal staff. Volunteers, workers rather, at the United Nations who have decided they will not abandon the Timorese who've taken refuge in their compound as well as the rest of the country. We'll have a live report from Dili with journalist Alan Nairn. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Today, we're going to once again break with the form of the show when we usually do 5 minutes of news headlines and then go on to the program, because I just got off the phone with Alan Nairn, who is the last U.S. journalist in Dili and now one of the only journalists in Dili since the evacuation that took place just hours ago, with hundreds of U.N. staff leaving, as well as a small number of journalists who were also in the UN compound. The situation is very grave. We'll talk about that in 1 minute. But before we go to Alan's live report and just let that play, there's another major story that is in the news today, and that is 11 members of the FALN who've been imprisoned for many years are going to be released. And Juan, you've been covering that story.
Yes, Amy, and it's amazing the continued furor that has erupted in this country over the president's decision to give conditional clemency to several of the nationalists, not all of them. And, you know, it's amazing, as you remarked earlier on a local show here, that it's the president's press conference today dealt with both East Timor and the FALN. And, you know, I've always felt that, you know, there's a lot of talk recently about what the 20th century has meant in terms of the major trends in the 20th century. And really, to me, the major thing that happened in the 20th century was not the battle between capitalism and socialism or World War I or World War II. It was that at the beginning of the century, three quarters of the world was controlled in colonies by the European powers and the United States. And an immense social revolution occurred in this century, the anti-colonial revolution, which changed the face of the earth. And here we are at the end of the 20th century, and the last two remaining colonial agendas for the United Nations are East Timor and Puerto Rico. Yesterday, President Clinton had to deal with both of those issues and what the United States' role has been in both. Unfortunately, the American people, because they're so ignorant of both, most don't even know where East Timor is, and both know very little about Puerto Rican history, continue to have misinformation about these issues. And I raised in a column today that the FALN thing is like O.J. Simpson all over again, a vast divide between the American people as to what they think has happened here with this clemency, and the Puerto Rican people, who are almost unanimous in their viewpoint that the 11 Puerto Rican nationals should come out of jail because they know the historical repression that has occurred against the independence movement by the FBI and federal agencies, and they understand that while they may not agree, all of them, with what the FALN did, they understand and view them as patriots. And I think there's an enormous divide between the American people and the 6.6 million Puerto Rican people, just as after the O.J. Simpson case, there was an immense divide revealed between how black America sees the criminal justice system and how white America sees the criminal justice system.
Now, we've been covering the story of the prisoners for quite a while now, but for listeners who perhaps haven't heard the program before or been following this issue, if you could just briefly tell us, Juan, of these 11 prisoners who will be released today, can you tell us who they are, what they represent, why they were in prison, and the conditions of the clemency?
Well, they were the 11 who are being released. There are still several who will remain in jail, either because the president did not grant them clemency or because they rejected the conditions of the clemency. The 11 were members of either the FALN or the Macheteros, two underground urban guerrilla organizations of the Puerto Rican independence movement that arose in the late 1970s and 1980s. And although the FALN has taken credit for about 130 bombings across the United States in the late 70s and in the early 80s. These particular people who were arrested in the Chicago Federal District and in Connecticut Federal District were not charged with directly with any of those bombings, but were charged with weapons possession and seditious conspiracy, trying to overthrow the U.S. government. And they never mounted a defense in two sets of trials. There's a lot of confusion about the sentences that they got in terms of the numbers of years, but the reality is that they faced two sets of trials, both in state court and in federal court, and the combined consecutive sentences to some of them averaged 70 years, even though they were basically charged with weapons possession and seditious conspiracy. Their sentences were far greater than people convicted of similar crimes, and as a result, the movement that developed to free them really hinged largely on this issue of the disparate sentencing, which was politically motivated to punish them. Because the reality is that of the 130 bombings that the FALN supposedly committed, only one person was ever convicted of setting any of those bombs, and one person was captured, William Morales, when he blew himself up in making bombs in New York, but he later escaped. And I think part of the attempt to punish these FALN members is the tremendous frustration that law enforcement felt over the years against the FALN, which was probably the most successful a clandestine armed organization in the history of the United States, in not being able to capture or prosecute any of the people who set these bombs. So I think that, but these particular people were not charged with any of those bombs, not convicted of any of those bombs, and because of that, the Clinton administration agreed with the calls for clemency by many people. And it was interesting to note the New York Post had a big article yesterday about how Cardinal O'Connor has said that he did not support the freedom of the clemency for the 11. I questioned the Cardinal spokesman because I have letters that the Cardinal wrote to Attorney General Reno. I have copies of the letters which clearly indicated that he was putting his side on the question of pardon for these nationalists, but I guess the Cardinal got so much pressure from law enforcement groups that he ended up saying that, yes, he had written these letters, but that he had been, everyone had misunderstood. He was just asking for a review of the cases, not taking a position on the clemency. It's unfortunate that the Cardinal, like Hillary Clinton, like a lot of people, have run for cover after the furor that arose based on misinformation among many Americans.
Well, Juan, today there will be great celebrations in Chicago, in New York, but many of the people who are being released today want to go to Puerto Rico.
Yes, 9 of the 11, and as I understand it, because they really do believe, even though many of them were raised in New York City, they do or Chicago, they do believe that if they stay in Chicago or New York City, they will be subject to constant harassment and vigilance by policemen or FBI agents who are outraged at their release. And I think many of them feel that their best chance of avoiding that kind of constant harassment is by returning to Puerto Rico, where even most of the, a lot of the FBI agents are Puerto Rican, certainly all the police are, and I think they feel that they have a better chance there of conducting normal lives again.
Well, we're going to move now, as that news conference did yesterday, between Puerto Rico and East Timor and the latest that is happening there. The Vatican is saying that Roman Catholic institutions have been singled out for attack by militias in East Timor and have called for a United Nations peacekeeping force to restore order. The church is responding to reports of slayings of about 100 people, including 4 Catholic priests, in an attack in a church in the southern town of Swai. Also, word is that another victim is said to be the head of the East Timorese office of the Catholic aid agency Caritas, the Reverend Francisco Barreto, a prominent voice for moderation in the territory. Also, other Caritas workers apparently have been killed. A well-known nun has been killed in Dili, and the Reverend José Carbonell of the Salesian Order said in Jakarta 6 nuns of the Canossian Order had been killed in the city of Baucau. The Roman Catholic Bishop of Baucau, Basilio de Nascimento, reported to have been wounded and forced to flee into the hills. This all coming as the United Nations compound is being evacuated of some UN personnel. Hundreds have flown to Darwin, but a number have volunteered to remain with the refugees who have taken refuge in the UN compound, braved razor wire, jumped over the fence to escape from the gunfire and the terror in Dili, the terror of the militias and the Indonesian military. And just before we went to air, we heard that heavy gunfire had broken out near the UN headquarters in East Timor. Just a few minutes ago, I spoke to Brian Kelly, the Deputy Chief of Information in Dili, one of the people who has said he will remain behind. He talked about the internally displaced people and the fact that a number left the compound when the gunfire broke out, and they have run off to hide, afraid that even the compound isn't safe. And just an hour before we are broadcasting this, I reached Alan Nairn, trying to reach him over the last 12 or 13 hours. It is extremely difficult. The Indonesian military turns on and off the whole cellular system at will. They had cut the landlines to the United Nations, the phone lines, but now some of them are back up. And since I was able to get him on the phone, we thought we would just run what he has to say. Alan has decided to stay in East Timor for now. This is his description of what's happening.
Well, Dili remains under a siege by the militias and the Indonesian army. This morning, the UNIMET, the United Nations, evacuated a substantial number of their international staff and their entire East Timorese staff, plus their families. As the convoys were going to the airport to be met at the airport by the Australian military, which was managing the physical evacuation, as that was happening, the ITARIC militias, which are run by the Indonesian army, they were gathering just a few streets away from the UN compound. And as soon as the final convoy had left from the airport, the ITARIC rode up on motorcycles. The ITARIC men dressed in their black T-shirts and red and white bandanas. One group of them went into the courtyard of a next-door church, which the UN has been using as a place to house some of the 2,000 refugees that have been sheltering there. They went into that courtyard demanding the keys to a truck, a UN truck, stealing motorcycles, some of which had been brought in by people who had fled, and also just mingling among and threatening to attack people in the crowd. As that was happening, another group of ITARIC people nearby rode up right near the entrance to the gates of the main UN compound. As this proceeded, there were many, many shots that were fired. From what I am told, it caused a great deal of fear among the refugees, who are mainly women and children. The refugees who are staying in the church schoolyard next to the main UN compound are many of them are either very old or very young. There's a great deal of terror there, and it also, from what I heard, really shook the UN. And that set the stage for a siege from the outside that has continued throughout the day. They've also continued to light fires throughout Dili, some very large, massive fires. There's one, I can't really tell exactly where it is, but it's along the Aria Branca, the white sand beach, or just back from the Aria Branca. It's in the general vicinity of a hospital. That may be what's burning. It's hard to make out in the distance, but very, very heavy plumes of black smoke rising to the air. They have also been burning buildings in the north, or rather south-central part of the city, which is the neighborhood where UN headquarters is located. So it's been a return to the terror tactics directed at whatever the remaining population of Dili is. I mean, it's not really clear now how many people remain in Dili in their homes. If I were forced to guess, I would guess less than half of the population. So directed against them and against foreigners and United Nations, clearly attempting to drive UN and foreign journalists and others out of Timor.
Alan, we haven't spoken to you since a revolt took place within the UN compound when the United Nations originally announced it was leaving. Can you explain what happened in the last day?
Well, I've lost track of time a bit, but on a number of nights ago, at a time when I was inside the UN compound, word went around, and this was accurate, it wasn't rumor, the word spread that UN was going to evacuate, but the evacuation... evacuation, that's the word they use for fleeing, for getting out of the country. It would only include the foreign UN personnel, the local Timorese UN staff, and the families of the Timorese staff, but the refugees would all be left behind, those who were sheltering inside the UN compound. That was the plan. It was a panicked flight for the hills on the part of the UN leadership. And when this happened several days ago, my understanding is that it happened on orders from New York, from UN headquarters there. But when word got around that this is what was in the works, it was just a very dramatic reaction. Among the refugees, there was a lot of anger, a lot of fear, because it was very clear at that moment, I think, that this would have meant almost certain death for the refugees inside the compound. All day long, and in fact for the two previous days, there had been a barrage of gunfire from automatic rifles and, in many cases, heavy machine guns, detonations of small either bombs or mortar pieces, grenades going off all around the UN compound. It was just nonstop barrage. And this was also the time when the burning of Dili was at its peak. So even that day, in the daytime, you could barely see the sun because there was so much ash and smoke in the air and everyone could smell it. And it really did look like the result would be a massacre in the making if the UN pulled out and left the local staff. I'm sorry, left the refugees. So what happened was a lot of people rebelled, said, no, we're not leaving, regardless of what army you have come in to take us out. And that included many of the UN staff.
Alan Nairn reporting to us from Dili. Don't worry, he hasn't been cut off. Just we're going to break Alan, a journalist who has decided to remain in East Timor as much of the UN pulls out, although a number of staff have volunteered to stay. As hundreds of refugees remain in the UN compound in Dili. We'll be back with Alan in just a minute as stations identify themselves here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we go back to Dili, East Timor. Again, the latest news from Dili. The UN pulling much of its staff out has just finished that operation as they head to Darwin, Australia, have already landed. And in East Timor, more and more word is coming out of the level of violence with nuns and priests, it looks like, have been targeted as well. The Vatican just beginning to find out around the country, since it's hard to get word outside of Dili, the capital, just how many people have been killed. We're speaking with journalist Alan Nairn. He is the only U.S. journalist in East Timor right now as we try to bring you daily dispatches from Dili. This is Alan describing what happened in the last few days, the debate within the UN compound after the United Nations had announced the UN would be withdrawing.
About 70 UN staff people signed a petition saying they were volunteering to stay behind. There were many others who were willing to go even further. Among the crew of foreign reporters who at that time, I guess, were, I don't know, maybe 20, 25, something like that. There was there was one group of us, at least half a dozen, I think, that was ready to sit down in front of the trucks if they tried to pull out to try to stop it. And many of the Timorese young people said that, the refugees said that once we started that they would join in too. And so you would have had this this real political spectacle if the UN tried to pull out. And it just added up to a lot of pressure from within the compound and also within the compound. And also, I think a number of the local UN people in leadership, they didn't want to go either. They didn't like this this idea. This all started, I think, I'm not remembering the days exactly, but I think it was the day I was on your show talking about the some of the covert U.S. military discussions with the PNI, the Indonesian military, about the militias. And I believe when we went on the air talking about that, this whole thing had started to brew a couple hours before. We all are in the process of just trying to organize this uprising against the UN decision. And also, it was very, 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 very tense time because many people were facing the prospect of death. I remember, in fact, I think when I came back from the place that they were, we had just spoken on the phone. This woman, this older Timorese woman, she came up and she grabbed my arm and she's they're going to come in and they're going to kill us all. The children, we're going to start with the children, and they're going to kill every single one of us. And, you know, that was probably a pretty accurate prediction at that moment. And then at the same time, among the foreigners, the UN staff and the journalists, you know, a lot of people were quickly having to make the decision, well, you know, are you willing to say, I'm going to stay behind no matter what if they do this pullout, which, you know, realistically, the way things stood politically at that point, did seem to look like it might have carried a risk of being killed. But, as it turned out, the little rebellion worked, and a couple hours later, the decision was reversed, and instead, the UN, what the UN ended up doing was very different. Some people did leave today. Some international people did leave today on the convoys to the airport, and all the local staff did leave, but there's still a very substantial UN group left behind, so with the refugees here in Dili. So what that means is that if the TNI, General Wiranto and the Indonesian Army, if they're thinking of going beyond, you know, shooting off the thousands of rounds and if they're thinking of actually storming the compound and trying to do a massacre, then politically they'll have quite an obstacle because there are lots and lots of foreigners in there. You know, one of the things that we said to UN leadership that night, this decision was in the works, was we said, you know, consider this, think about what you're doing, because you'll have a lot of Timorese blood on your hands. You know, I have to say, that's not so unusual for Western countries. But we also said to them, you'll also have some American blood on your hands, some British blood, some Australian blood. Think about that in terms of your cold politics. And that's still the fact that Wiranto is facing, if he's thinking about you know, storming the compound. So it turned out that, you know, people just refusing to accept that initial, I think, panicked. I think the UN got panicked when they made that first decision, but people refusing to accept that worked out and held it, essentially reversed what was a naked slaughter in the making.
And yet, as the Indonesian regime is saying, they're getting violence under control as if they're not instigating it. Brian Kelly, the deputy chief of information in Dili, who remains there, said, as you were describing, Itarik coming into the parking lot next door, walking right past the military, and that UN personnel watched as the military, together with the Itarik, smashed one of the cars.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that was the least of it. You know, from what I hear, it was, they were especially menacing the refugees in the schoolyard attached to the compound, and it was pretty clear from the way they were all set up that they were threatening an all-out attack. Especially because of the timing, because this started, probably 5 minutes or less than 5 minutes after the last of the convoys had left for the airport, you know, with those who were going out. So the convoys that went to the airport hadn't even, you know, the drivers of the trucks and so on hadn't even come back yet. So it was very clear what was going on, and it was also, as always, it's completely obvious, beyond any kind of reasonable question, that we're talking about General Wiranto, the Indonesian Army here.
Alan, a few quick questions to ask you. One is, what's happened to the refugees who've left the compound? I just spoke to Brian Kelly, the spokesperson for the UN, still inside the compounds. He said they went to Dare, which is another pro-independence area in Dili. Are they in grave danger? Why did they leave?
Well, some have left. It's not clear exactly how many have, but actually, even before the panic of the other night, some refugees had started to filter out and go over the wall and back of the compound. And since the UN compound sits at the base of a very steep mountain that involves a tough climb, and it's also a mountain that has very few trees. I was talking today to a Timorese refugee who was comparing what's happening now to Matabian, the Matabian days. Matabian is a mountain in central east Timor. It's actually great, of legendary and religious significance to the Timorese. And it's also a place that was heavily bombed by the Indonesian army military using planes supplied by Ford and Carter, by Jimmy Carter, especially during 1977. OB-10 Broncos came in, dropped napalm, helicopters were machine-gunning people. Everybody who was there remembers the Matabian attack. And this young man who was telling me this, he was just a little kid at the time, but he has some memories of it. He said, the way he put it, even though thousands were killed there, and this is typical of the way many Timorese speak, because they live in a reality that most of us in the world are not adjusted to. He said, well, yeah, Matabian wasn't bad at all. Matabian was really very easy because there were so many rocks there, and you could hide under the rocks. So, you know, as the bombs were dropping and as the machine gun fire was coming down, as the napalm was coming down, there were places to hide. But, as he said this, he was talking about it in comparison to the hills behind the UN compound. He said, that's terrible. That's really bad because if you try to go up those hills, you really have very few hiding places. There's not much in the way of rocks and all that many trees. So as some of the refugees have decided that, you know, their options weren't good and decided to try to hop the fence and make the climb, I mean, one of the several kinds of terror that surround the UN operation here is people standing there and looking up at the hill and seeing if they can see refugees, and then seeing if they can see soldiers, TNI, Indonesian Army soldiers, and then listening to the shots as the soldiers try to pick people off. The other day, at least two were shot, as far as is known. It wouldn't be at all surprising if we later learn that many more than that have been shot. At least hundreds have fled the compound and made that climb. And there's certainly more who try it every day. I really don't know how many refugees are left inside, but it's still a very large number who are still inside the UN compound. And they know that if they try to go out and up the hill, they're going to be part of target practice as the target for the Indonesian army. You know, many of those bullets come from the United States. Because even though the U.S. has cut off the sale of small arms, it's supposed to have cut off the sale of small arms that happened in '94 in response to grassroots pressure. The logic of the move was such that, well, it's unacceptable to sell them machine guns and the M16s and pistols and so on, but it's okay to send the bullets for them. So if refugees are considering climbing the hill, you know, they know that they meet up with a bullet from Olin Winchester. If you actually recover some of the bullets and look at the markings, it says Olin Winchester.
We're talking to Alan there. And Alan, are you in the UN compound in Dili?
Well, I'm in Dili.
Alan Nairn speaking to us from Dili, East Timor. When we come back, we'll get response from him to President Clinton's announcement yesterday that military relations between Indonesia and the United States have been cut off for now, and as well that
he suggested the IMF and the World Bank were suspending the current loans that they were about to give to Indonesia, although he didn't say anything about cutting off commercial weapons sales from the United States to Indonesia. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with Alan Nairn and his Timor in just a minute. Alan, I'm afraid the phone is going to cut off, and I wanted to ask you about what has happened here in the United States with last night President Clinton holding a news conference and announcing, well, we have to separate words from what he actually imposed. He said that he'd ordered the Pentagon to suspend its few formal contacts with the Indonesian military and that he would consider economic sanctions if the killings in East Timor didn't stop. But he didn't threaten an immediate cutoff of economic assistance to Indonesia, as lawmakers and human rights groups have wanted. Also, he did not cut off commercial arms sales to Indonesia, which are expected to total, in the New York Times, they're saying, $16 million over the next year. Can you respond, though? He also said that he would support an international peacekeeping force led by Australia, though William Cohen has been the defense secretary has been saying that there would not be U.S. soldiers involved with this. Can you respond to all of this and the fact that the man that you exposed in your piece in The Nation, U.S. Complicity in Timor, a day after your piece came out, a few hours after, he was in Jakarta telling Wiranto, the military commander, that he was cutting off military relations. You exposed, in fact, that he originally had gone to Jakarta a while ago, supposed to tell him that they were cutting, that they should stop militias, and instead was offering him all sorts of deals.
Yeah, well, I guess the public announcement was that Blair was, that Admiral Blair, the CINCPEC, the Pacific commander, was there telling Wiranto that USAID was being cut. I'd like to see the confidential cable about that meeting also, today's or yesterday's meeting also, because previously Blair did the opposite of what he was supposed to do, or what he was assigned to do, ostensibly. I don't know the exact detail of this cutoff by Clinton. I mean, you're just saying now that it doesn't include commercial arms sales. It's the first I've heard of that. I'd say a couple things about it. One, it is a tremendous political victory for American activists and those in the American public who've been campaigning very, very hard for this for about 8 years now, since the Dili massacre. Although it's pretty clear that it's only a partial victory, but it does sound like a step. It does sound like a major break in Clinton's support for terror in Indonesia and occupied Timor. You know, when you talk to people actually possible sometimes to defeat the incumbent president and defeat the incumbent Pentagon and State Department, and working through the Congress force them to do things they don't want to do, like forcing them to cut off the IMET military training and the JSET training. Those are two big training programs for Indonesia, and stopping F-16 sales and many other kinds of sales, and to sometimes, occasionally, win those victories through grassroots pressure. This is, it sounds like a very big victory. But even if it is pretty much what it looks like, even if there isn't fine print that weakens it, I don't think it's quite enough. I think it's getting there. But this is not going to be enough to make it clear to Urantu that the U.S. is serious. Because Urantu is a smart guy. He knows how politics are played. And temporary cutoffs are one of the old political tricks. In fact, the U.S. used an announced temporary cutoff in 1975 at the time of the Timor invasion. As the Indonesian army was invading Timor, the U.S. announced publicly that they were cutting off arms sales to Indonesia. And, you know, some fanfare like now. But in fact, what later came out was what they really did was they continued deliveries of the existing arms that were in the pipeline. They continued the negotiations and discussions about contracts for particular weapons that were in the works, negotiations that were in the works. What they actually did is not quite clear. I guess they didn't deliver any new weapons during the period of the suspension, but you know, they were just sitting there waiting. They were just sitting there in the warehouses of the Pentagon and the warehouses of General Electric and Northrop and McDonnell Douglas and Grumman and all the others. And then a few weeks or a couple months, in that case, I don't remember how long it was. It wasn't long. It was certainly less than 6 months. Then they said, okay, we're suspending it. And they went back to the deliveries. And in that case, there were many in the Indonesian military who said that they hadn't even realized that there had been a suspension because of the way it had been handled. So if this is just a temporary move, if this is just Clinton responding to the rising pressure, then it will be very easy for Urantu to see that, especially since the messenger of all people is Admiral Blair, the man who the first time was sent in to tell him to shut down the militias and instead, I guess, got confused and ended up telling them that he ought to come up to his house for dinner at Pacific Command in Hawaii and giving him his heartfelt pledge that the Pentagon would lobby to restore the IMET military training in Congress, pledging him a whole list of other political plums. So this all depends on how it's read, and if Urantu thinks that this may be temporary or the U.S. isn't cutting off everything, he's not going to respond to it. So it has to be more and tougher.
Well, for your information, he was disinvited from going to Hawaii. I don't know if it was because of your piece exposing this or what, but that was part of the break-off in military relations.
That was one of the things. Well, I guess Urantu will have to make other dinner plans that evening. But, yeah, that's not quite enough. There's a very, very long, you know, there's a myth. There's a real myth going around in U.S. politics and also inside the U.S. military. Many military people themselves are misinformed about this. A myth that currently the U.S. military dealings with Indonesia are minimal. They're not. It's very complicated the way they do it. Very, very, in a very Byzantine way, you know, the contacts are kind of strung throughout the vast Pentagon bureaucracy, but there are lots of them. There are lots of links. Those all have to be severed.
Alan Nairn speaking to us from Dili, East Timor, as he calls for a total arms embargo against the Indonesian regime, as well as an international aid embargo. Groups around the world are demanding that now. And while President Clinton made a major step yesterday in talking about punishing Indonesia if they don't stop the violence, he did not go as far as that. And if people want to get in touch with President Clinton, he's headed off to Auckland, New Zealand for the APEC summit. You can still call the White House. You can be sure he does get his messages, or at least he gets the overall count on how many messages come in. The number is 202-456-1414. That's 202-456-1414. Again, today's news, the UN, a large part of it, pulling out of East Timor. The Vatican saying that Catholic institutions have been singled out for attack by militias in East Timor. The Archbishop Jean-Louis Taran, the Vatican's foreign minister, said, "We are facing another genocide, a genocide that does not spare the Catholic Church." And at the end of today's program, we go to another subject. By the way, I just want to say that Alan is in East Timor in defiance of a military ban against him. He reentered 4 months ago. Indonesia has been researching his piece on the U.S. relationship with the Indonesian military and militias, and got into East Timor also in defiance of that ban. But tomorrow, on Saturday, September 11th, that's 9/11, artists around the country will participate in Mumia 911, a national day of art to stop the execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Artists will be creating and performing works, holding concerts, dedicating their events to Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row in Pennsylvania. Events and performances will be held in Seattle, Boston, New York, Las Vegas, Hawaii, and around the world, in places like Berlin and Tasmania and Barcelona. We're joined by two artists now who will be participating in events. Jessica Kerr Moore is a poet and playwright, founder of Moore Black Press. And we're joined by Danny Hock, actor and solo performer. His three solo shows, Pot Melting, Some People, and Jails, Hospitals, and Hip Hop, have toured over 50 cities to sold-out houses. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Yeah. Danny, can we start with you? Why are you participating in this Mumia 911 campaign?
Well, first of all, they asked me, but mostly, really, we have to, I think it's important for artists to come together around issues like this. I think Mumia represents a variety of issues, not just, you know, the fact that he needs to be free because he doesn't belong where he is, but he brings artists together on sort of a multi-layer stage, as it were, you know, whether it's police brutality or the death penalty or the prison industrial complex or political prisoners in general. There's so many reasons for me personally to be involved, as well as artists all over the country.
And Jessica Kerr Moore, what will you be doing tomorrow?
I'm performing with about 15 other poets at the New Eureka Poets Cafe. And it's basically just a reading. All of us will be speaking on whatever we want to speak about. But it's some of the, you know, highest poets in New York City just coming together for Mumia. And the reason why it's important that we're involved and why I've gotten myself involved is not only just because of Mumia. It's just, I mean, in general, political prisoners. It's something that we all need to be talking about. And our generation is affected by the prison system more than anybody. I mean, especially young black men, and even now more than ever, more women of color are on lockdown. And so we can't ignore that. And so this is a major issue for us, because police brutality, you know, we're victims of that on a regular basis. And so, and our generation needs to be talking about this more. And so a lot of us talk about it in our shows already. But it's very powerful to have artists around the country and internationally, you know, being basically the voice for the voiceless, which we're supposed to be doing anyway. So it's a great event, and I'm excited to be part of it.
And Jessica, I know that the concert that was held in New Jersey around Mumia attracted a lot of press attention, most of it condemning from the corporate press, condemning the event. But I think they may have realized that they actually then helped to publicize and bring more people to it, because this time around there's been almost a complete silence from a lot of the major media around this event. Are you concerned at all in terms of the threats of boycotts by law enforcement groups to artists who get involved with Mumia's campaign?
No, I'm not. Threats by police are everyday thing. So, I mean, I live in Harlem, so, you know, this place is like, you know, police. It's a police state anyway. and with the, you know, what happened last year with the Million Youth March and how the police attacked the people then. And so it's, you know, that's not anything we're not used to already. It's not going to stop the National Day of Art. Art is going to continue no matter what. You can't really stop that.
Let me ask Danny Hawk, are you going to be performing tomorrow, and do you want to, we only have a minute, but share some of what you're going to be doing?
I wrote a short play that's going to be presented tomorrow, along with works by Zaki Shange and Sonia Sanchez and Keith Antar Mason, Culture Clash, Martina Spala, at the Public Theater at 8 o'clock. It's free. It's going to be pretty amazing. We're also going to be having a panel on arts and activism related to the National Day of Art.
But in terms of your performance, any words from it?
I'm not personally going to perform tomorrow night, but I wrote a little something. I don't know if I could quote it this early in the morning.
Sure you can.
Oh, I don't know. I'm going to light a fire with my mind. How about that?
Good.
Jessica could do a lot better than me,
you
I think.
You know what?
Go ahead, Jessica.
Oh, just a little piece of poetry?
Sure.
Because liberty is just old Mother Nature, and although you don't love her, she'll never hate you. She's earth, wind, and fire. Don't tempt her to show her power. Turn it all weeds to flowers. Look into her wise eyes and make a blind man see. How can you dare name a Eurocentric girl after me? Asada Shakur, Barbara Jordan, Nikki Giovanni, and Angela Davis. These are the true symbols of liberty, because that stone-faced French woman ain't going to save us, the same folks who enslaved us. I'm sitting at the back of the bus because I feel like it, and I play ball because you pay me to dunk it, dribble, or hike it, taking all my people back home and breaking them mentally free. I'm the walking, talking, breathing, beautiful statue of liberty. You know,
yes.
That's a little paragraph. A little paragraph of poetry.
Well,
what I'm going to be doing tomorrow, I don't know yet, because you know you only get a certain amount of time, and there's so many wonderful artists performing. What piece we'd be doing, I don't know, but hopefully it'll be something that will have some great impact on the people in the audience.
Well, I want to give out the number for people around the country if they want to be involved in this day, Mumia 911. It's 888, it's toll-free, 888-456-5056, and find out what's happening in your neighborhood. That's 888-456-5056. Also, September 12th, Sunday, is Leonard Peltier's 55th birthday. He remains in Leavenworth for more than two decades. In fact, President Clinton is also considering his clemency. I don't know what the response to the Puerto Rican prisoners' clemency how that will impact on Leonard Peltier. But I know also that the Puerto Rican activists who will be released today will be participating in events tomorrow with Mumia 911. Well, that does it for today's program, and I want to thank both of our guests for ending it for us, Danny Hawk and Jessica Caremore, two artists will be participating in Mumia 911. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, the number to call is 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We are doing extremely significant broadcasts out of East Timor. No one else is doing this, and we urge you to call newspapers and journalists to let them know. Go to our website. You can listen to the show afterwards. Tell friends to listen. Our website is www.pacifica.org. You can also go to the show that we did on Wednesday when Alan Aaron broke the story of the U.S. military relationship with the militias in Timor. David Love produced today's show, as did Donna Neiman. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks to Matthew Finch, our engineer. Thanks for listening.